Now it's time to look back at the events and personalities of 1984. Michael Vesti presents the News Review of the Year.
You hear about these atrocities, these bombs. You don't expect them to happen to you.
I've lived with danger all my life, and it makes no difference whether you die in bed or you die standing up.
We regret to announce the death of the Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi.
This union are not going to be defeated. We're going to win the fight to keep our pits open, jobs secure, and our industry intact.
Death is all around. A child or an adult dies every 20 minutes.
A machine gun came out the window of the Libyan embassy, fired into the protesters.
The UN team up and yeah.
Winner of the gold medal, representing Great Britain, Daley Thompson.
Some of the sounds of 1984, the year which will forever be associated with George Orwell. But the reality is now on its way into the history books, and one of the things they'll reflect is the continuing threat to world leaders and all politicians from the terrorist and the fanatic. In Britain, the bomber struck in October. The target was the Prime Minister and most of her cabinet. They were staying at the Grand Hotel in Brighton for the Conservative Party conference. Five people were killed and many more injured. Mrs. Thatcher spoke to reporters half an hour after the attack.
The bomb went off somewhere between 2:45 and 3:00. I know that because I looked up when I'd finished something at 2:45, and I just turned to do one final paper, and then it went off. My husband was in bed, and all the windows went, and the bathroom was extremely badly
damaged. In your own room?
Yes,
in your room.
Yes. We were very lucky. You hear about these atrocities, these bombs. You don't expect them to happen to you. But life must go on as usual.
And your conference will go on?
The conference will go on as usual.
The conference is going to go on. Our determination is unshaken. It's not a question of individuals. It's a question of the nation not going to be held to ransom or brought to a stop by acts of violence of this kind. And the fact that it happens to have come so close to those of us at the centre of government is certainly not going to do anything other than reinforce our resolve to be quite resolute in the face of this sort of thing.
I just felt a tremendous crashing. I thought it was an earthquake. I was on the 7th floor. They tell me they dug me out on the 5th floor. So I went down 2 floors. And I'm very thankful. I mean, I prayed.
The firemen are now getting close to Mr. Tebbit. He's in a crouching position with the rubble of his room more or less on his back. So what sort of condition is he in?
Well, I think reasonably good considering he's fallen probably 3 or 4 floors.
What was he saying to you?
He was concerned, I think, about his wife and that he be brought out as quickly as possible, which is not surprising.
Then we saw Mr. Tebbit's feet. The firemen worked very gingerly to free him without further injury. A stretcher went up. It began to look more hopeful for the minister. He was moaning just audibly. It was only yesterday afternoon that the delegates had risen to him in the longest-standing ovation of the conference. Many would commend his fortitude in this terrible circumstance. The rescue had taken 4 hours. The time was 6:50. He was lowered, oh so gently, to the ground. Someone said to the fireman, "Well done, lads."
It was an attempt not only to disrupt and terminate our conference. It was an attempt to cripple Her Majesty's democratically elected government. That is the scale of the outrage in which we have all shared. And the fact that we are gathered here now, shocked, but composed and determined, is a sign not only that this attack has failed, but that all attempts to destroy democracy by terrorism will fail.
The IRA said they'd planted the bomb, and a few days later Mrs. Thatcher talked of the moment when she realised how close they'd come to killing her.
I think in church on Sunday morning, it was a lovely morning. We haven't had many lovely days. And the sun was just coming through the stained glass windows and falling on some flowers right across the church. And it just occurred to me that this was the day I was meant not to see. Had you been able to see the previous Sunday, what would happen during the coming week. You couldn't have endured it. You just couldn't have endured it. So it's as well we can't see into the future.
A fortnight later, gunmen shot and killed Mrs. Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister of India. They were Sikhs avenging the assault by the Indian army on their holiest shrine, the Golden Temple in Amritsar. 1,000 people had died when the army stormed the temple in June to force out the armed followers of the Sikh leader Sant Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale, who was one of those killed. Satish Jacob in Delhi reported on the assassination of Mrs. Gandhi and the bloody aftermath.
Mrs. Gandhi was shot by two of her security guards at her residence in the morning. She had come out and was walking towards her office where she was due to give a television interview. The other security guards tried to overpower the two assassins, and in the ensuing scuffle, one of them was killed. The official announcement was made by All India Radio.
We regret to announce the death of the Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi. She was critically injured this morning at a residence when she was shot by some security, and she was immediately rushed to All India Medical Institute, where she succumbed to her injuries.
Riots broke out in various parts of the country. In Delhi, Bombay, Calcutta, Lucknow, Kanpur and Patna, armed mobs attacked shops, houses and vehicles belonging to Sikhs.
Officials say that it was the Prime Minister herself who insisted on retaining Sikh members of her personal security staff, even though she knew that Sikh extremists had threatened to kill her. They made the threats after the army action in the Golden Temple in Amritsar in June. One of her killers had just returned from 2 months' leave in Punjab, the Sikh home state.
In Calcutta, the army has been called in to assist the police after buses and trams were set on fire by irate crowds. In Delhi, the capital, buses, lorries and shops belonging to Sikhs were burnt.
A mob of hooligans is standing outside the house of a Sikh and they're throwing stones in. They're throwing chairs, everything they can lay their hands in. Up and down the street, cars are blazing, there's broken glass and once again, a pall of smoke rising over the city. Now the mob have carried a burning chair into the house. You can hear the clapping. They're trying to set fire to the house. In a few moments, this place will be on fire as well, as so much else is around this city.
In general, you know, all Sikhs, their houses are either stoned or burnt. You know, our taxis, I'm doing taxi business. Our taxis, most of the taxis have been burned. Six have been killed.
Her son Rajiv. Six. Abjoyo. And with this fire, he walks around the body of his mother. He touches the sandalwood logs at various places, and the flames begin to creep up over the logs. Fog of dust mingling now with the smoke and the smell of meadow grass as the flames lick over the body and begin to consume the late Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi.
Rajiv Gandhi succeeded his mother as Prime Minister and just this week confirmed himself in office by winning a general election. At home, 1984 will long be remembered as the year of the miners' strike. It started in March and is still going on. The BBC's Labour correspondent, Nicholas Jones, has followed the dispute from the very beginning.
When the strike started in early March, the miners were already entering the fifth month of an overtime ban after the collapse of their pay talks. It was the continuing pit closures one by one throughout the coalfields that finally sparked off the strike. On March the 1st came news of the Corton Wood closure in Yorkshire. The attempt to get a national strike without a pit head ballot was only days away. On March the 6th, Arthur Scargill and the rest of the union leadership saw Ian McGregor to hear the coal board's plans for another cut in the industry's capacity.
This is a modest rundown in the industry. We're going to reduce the capacity by about 4 million tonnes out of about 101 million tonnes.
Mr. McGregor, are you frightened by the prospect of a strike if that's what happens in the coal industry in view of the calls in Yorkshire and Scotland?
I think it would be very, very sad. It would be a form of self-destruction.
This fresh attack upon our industry is further evidence. Mr. Ian McGregor intends to inflict the same savage butchery on the coal industry that he inflicted upon BL and the British steel industry. We shall do all in our power to resist this closure programme, and we would urge all our members to continue to support union policy to defend their pit and their jobs.
By the following Monday, nearly half Britain's miners were on strike. The union hoped for a domino effect. Flying pickets from Yorkshire moved south to Nottinghamshire. At Ollerton, there was the first death. A young miner collapsed on the picket line. There were more mass pickets outside the steelworks as lorry convoys began moving coal to Llanwern and Ravenscraig. The biggest demonstration of all was at the Orgreave Cokeworks near Sheffield. 6,000 pickets faced 3,000 policemen. Among the reporters was Bob Sinkinson.
More what are termed as shield units are moving out, police carrying 6-foot plastic shields and wearing helmets. And the mounted police are going in again. At a full gallop, right up the hill, in the face of missiles. The horses and the police officers are being stoned. In fact, a barrage of stones are being hurled at the mounted police as they now come back down the road, having pushed the pickets further back.
It's the worst I've ever seen. There wasn't any trouble at all until the police started charging. The police got on the horses and just charged. 30 horses just charged straight in and galloping. All swinging batons. I mean, I've been buried. But I've never been as terrified as I've been today. Never. When three horses come up with batons, I thought I was going to get killed.
One of those injured that day was Arthur Scargill. He spent the night in hospital. Soon, though, he was back at the negotiating table. The first of the two national dock strikes had alarmed the government, so had a run on the pound. Significant concessions were about to be offered. The coal board would review its closure programme. The five pits most at risk would, for the moment, be kept open. But the negotiations collapsed. The talks failed over one word, beneficial. Ian McGregor had still wanted closures which would benefit the industry. The miners' union said no.
I'm sure that people will draw their own conclusions from the fact that, having got so far, one word which they wanted to insert has in fact been responsible for stopping what we regard would have been a successful solution to the problem.
We've marched as far forward as we could towards the NUM position, and we've done everything we could to try to come up with a formula that would help resolve some of their concerns. But it looks like it's going to be quite a while before anything can be done.
And Mr. McGregor was right. As the strike continued throughout the summer, the miners' union looked ahead to the TUC conference in September and Mr. Scargill's appeal for wider support.
Ian McGregor's objective is a simple one. It's not merely to inflict a defeat on the National Union of Mine Workers or to close down 70 of our pits with the resulting loss of 70,000 jobs. His policy, which is being earmarked by this government, is to defeat you as a trade union movement, because our fight is your fight.
And the miners did get conference support, but the following day there was a warning over the violence seen during the dispute. It was the Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock who raised the issue.
Violence distracts attention from the central issues of the dispute. It obscures the justice and the validity of the miners' case. Violence has given the government a bone of excuses to gnaw on. It has given them the opportunity to evade the responsibility they have for the promotion of a settlement in this dispute.
Once the conference was over, it was back to the negotiating. The talks moved south through Edinburgh, Doncaster and London, but again without success. Then came unexpected support from church leaders. The new Bishop of Durham, Dr. David Jenkins, said the miners mustn't be defeated. He called for the removal of Ian McGregor.
The withdrawal of an imported elderly American to leave a reconciling opportunity for some local product is surely neither dishonourable nor improper.
Then came another twist. The pit deputies voted to strike. The coal board feared this could close even the working pits. It took several days of talks at the Conciliation Service ACAS to settle that dispute. The government hoped it might pave the way to an end to the miners' strike. But the safeguards over pit closures weren't sufficient.
There can be no compromise, as far as this union is concerned, on the question of closure of pits or the destruction of jobs. We are not prepared after 7 months to concede one point on this central question. We are demanding that our jobs be protected. We're demanding that our pits be kept open, and above all else, we're demanding that this industry be protected in line with Plan for Coal.
That refusal to give way triggered off a change in tactic by the coal board and moves to encourage a return to work. In the last 2 months of the year, the board said well over 16,000 miners abandoned the strike. This led to more violence, including the death of a taxi driver. As the year drew to a close, it was legal action by working miners and sequestration of the miners' money that provided a new focus for the dispute. A special union conference decided to ignore the courts. The union vice president, Mick McGahey, had this encounter with an officer trying to serve a court order.
Violence annoys me. You have an order.
Please, sir.
I have an order for you. Get out of my bloody road. Cheerio, pal.
The strikers and their families weren't forgotten. Gifts of money, food and presents for the children arrived in the coal fields. It was a show of solidarity by trade unionists here and overseas for what had become the longest national strike in Britain this century.
Abroad, relations between the superpowers were at a low ebb as the year started. The Geneva arms control talks had collapsed, and there was much ill feeling over the shooting down of a South Korean airliner over Soviet territory. East met West in January at the European Security Conference in Stockholm, but the atmosphere was tense and the rhetoric loud. The Soviet leadership had change thrust upon it in February, with the death of President Yuri Andropov. He was 69 and had been in power for just 15 months.
After a prolonged illness, the General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, Yuri Andropov, passed away.
He was succeeded by Konstantin Chernenko, at 72, the oldest man ever to take control in the Kremlin. But if there was change in Moscow, there was nothing of the sort in Washington. President Reagan scored a landslide victory in the presidential election, winning 49 of the 50 states and a record number of votes in the Electoral College. It was a personal triumph for him and for his style of leadership.
We've come together again, we're united again, and now let's start building together and keep that prairie fire alive, and let's never stop shaping that society which lets each person's dreams unfold into a life of unending hope. America's best days lie ahead. And you know, you forgive me, I'm going to do it just one more time. You ain't seen nothing yet.
The Democratic candidate for the presidency, Mr. Walter Mondale, won only his home state of Minnesota and announced that he was retiring from public life. During the election campaign, Mr. Reagan had addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations and had called for a new beginning in East-West relations to remove the dread of nuclear war. In Moscow, President Chernenko spoke of his willingness to be an honest partner in talks with the United States. But it still came as a surprise when it was announced in November that the two sides had agreed to hold talks on a wide range of issues, including arms control and space, in January. But if relations between Moscow and Washington are showing signs of improvement, there's no such prospect in the Gulf, where Iran and Iraq continue their bitter and protracted war. Their hostilities spread to the Gulf itself, where shipping was attacked by both sides. Middle East politics also spread to this country. Bombs directed against Arab targets went off in London and Manchester, and five Libyans were ordered out of the country. In April, a small demonstration outside the Libyan People's Bureau in St. James's Square, London, led to tragedy. Shots were fired from the building, and a young woman police constable, Yvonne Fletcher, was killed.
Suddenly, there was an incredibly sharp and almost cynical burst of fire. It was unbelievable that that sort of thing could happen to such an insignificant demonstration, that suddenly people were firing heavy caliber machine guns at them in the middle of a London square from an embassy.
The shots came out of the area of the embassy. One of the windows were open about 2-3 foot, and then when it had finished, it was closed and the curtains drawn back down again.
I saw a young policewoman, blonde in her late 20s, fall on her right-hand side and her hat rolled into the gutter, and she fell clutching her groin and her stomach. And about three officers ran to her assistance.
The government has protested very strongly, both here and in AAA,
to the Libyan government about an outrageous abuse of the premises occupied by the Libyan People's Bureau.
They faced an armored British attack by air and the ground. I heard that the British police force shot the bureau. It is very, very serious, and we are surprised how a responsible state like England carry on committed this crime.
It was a barbaric outrage. It is inconceivable that following it, normal relations between this country and Libya could continue. All Libyan diplomatic staff in London and anyone else currently in the Libyan People's Bureau in St. James's Square will now be required to leave the country.
They're now coming out of the building. There are five walking in single file across the west of the square, out of line of sight, behind the trees, and behind also that policeman's helmet, which is still lying there at the scene of the shooting.
They were led away into Duke of York Street, where we satisfied ourselves that they were not carrying arms or explosives, and I'm not prepared to discuss the means by which that was done. We verified their identities and their status, and they then climbed into seven green police minibuses and were driven away from the scene with a police escort and with diplomatic observers and other Libyan representatives present.
Two handguns and a quantity of ammunition have been discovered in the course of the search of the former bureau premises. Firearms residue has been found on the carpet below the window from which the weapon was believed to have been fired, and a spent cartridge case of the same caliber as the weapon used on the 17th April has been found in the same room. The police are of the view that it is likely that the murder was committed by one of two people who were in the bureau. Both of these possessed diplomatic immunity.
Unusually, there was some good news from Lebanon during the year. The peacekeeping forces of Britain, the United States, France, and Italy withdrew, and the various militia groups in Beirut agreed to hand over their positions in the city to the Lebanese army. Jim Muir watched the barricades come down.
Three huge bulldozers are now smashing their way through the huge earth walls and mounds and reinforcement fortifications which have divided this city for the last 6 months. Where I'm standing now, it would have been quite impossible to stand just 24 hours ago, because the positions just about 50 yards away were held on the one side by fighters from the Shiite Amal militia and on the other by the right-wing Christian Lebanese Forces militia. The plan is that this whole line will be completely dismantled, these elaborate fortifications that have grown up over the months, and the capital will once again be reunited.
But it seems violence is never far from Beirut. In September, 23 people were killed and 60 injured in a suicide bomb attack on the new American embassy in East Beirut. The fighting of 40 years ago was commemorated on June the 6th, the 40th anniversary of D-Day, when more than 130,000 Allied troops landed on the beaches of Normandy in the biggest amphibious invasion in military history. The Queen and President Reagan were among the heads of state who went to France to pay tribute to those who died. But it was essentially a day of remembrance for those who survived and those with memories of men who did not.
Like the 5,000 veterans who came to honour their fallen comrades, the blossoming horse chestnut trees, saplings 40 years ago, have reached maturity to become a dominating feature of the cemetery. The men who stormed into Normandy, wearied now by age, stood in silence with the Queen, Prince Philip, President Mitterrand and his wife to remember the sacrifice of more than 4,000 British and Commonwealth soldiers who are buried here. Their thoughts were put into words by Archdeacon W.F. Johnston, Chaplain General to the Land Forces.
Those whom we knew and whose memory we cherish, and all who, not counting the cost, have preserved for us the precious heritage of freedom. We give thanks for their courage, their devotion to duty, and their comradeship. and we continue to pray that we may walk worthy of their sacrifice.
This is the first time I've been back since the war, and I never realised that it would touch me so much. Yeah, you know, try to be a hard chap, but there are times when you're not too hard after all, are you?
You never forget your first battle, because it has an awful, leaves an awful impression on you.
Is it the first time you've been back since 1944?
The first time. And the bad memories come back.
What particularly?
Chaps I left here. But that is a war. Some live, some die.
From the top of the little wall, I had the view on the sea. And the sea was full of ships, big ones, small ones, and nearly no more sea. That was 7 o'clock in the morning on 6th of June. And that has been and will be the sight of my life.
The year began with more trouble in France, at least for British lorry drivers carrying carcasses of lamb. A number of them were forced to stop and had their loads contaminated or stolen by French farmers protesting against cheap meat imports. At the end of January, the government announced that staff employed at GCHQ, the intelligence gathering centre at Cheltenham, would no longer be allowed to join a trade union. Ministers argued that industrial action could jeopardise its operations, but there was immediate and sustained criticism of the decision, which had been announced by the Foreign Secretary, Sir Geoffrey Howe.
Staff will be permitted in future to belong only to a departmental staff association approved by their director. The government fully respects the right of civil servants to be members of a trade union, and it is only the special nature of the work of the GCHQ which has led us to take these measures.
What they're really saying is that trade unionism is inconsistent with being a patriotic civil servant dealing with sensitive, intelligent matters. It is quite incredible.
We are not prepared to accept that this government or any other government in a free country can lay down what trade union any individual should or should not join. That ought to be a choice for the individuals and not for the government.
Diabolical. Absolutely diabolical. They talk about Russia and Poland and all the rest of it, but by God, we're just the same, aren't we?
The issue has still not been resolved. The Law Lords ruled that the ban was justified because national security was involved, but the union say they'll take the case to the European Commission on Human Rights. One civil servant who made news during the year was Sarah Tisdall, a junior clerk at the Foreign Office. She leaked a document to the Guardian newspaper which gave details of the arrival of cruise missiles in Britain, and she was jailed for 6 months under the Official Secrets Act. A 23-year sentence was passed on Michael Bettany, an MI5 officer who offered to work for the KGB. The weather at the beginning of the year was appalling, with hurricane-force winds and the worst blizzards in Scotland for more than 20 years. But throughout those early months, two people captured the country's attention, Jane Torvill and Christopher Dean, entranced millions as they became successively European, Olympic and world ice dance champions.
Across the board. That's it. What a marvellous, marvellous set of marks. A complete set there. What could be more convincing? 12 in all, in fact. That is a marvellous, marvellous end to this Olympic competition. Jane Torvill and Christopher Dean have won the gold medal of the 1984 Olympic ice dance competition.
The Summer Olympics in Los Angeles were marred by a Soviet-led boycott, but the first commercial games lacked nothing in drama and spectacle.
The United States
get the bronze medal, 37.84, and for the first time in the Colosseum, a world record is shattered by this fantastic quartet from the United States of America. Carl Lewis collects his fourth gold medal of the Games and collects a world record as well.
What a marvellous moment this is for British rowing. Great Britain are going to win a gold. They're now half a length ahead. Great Britain are going to win this gold. Just a couple of feet to go. Great Britain have won the gold.
Tessa Sanderson throws, and it's a big one. It's way into the lead. It's close to the 70-metre line. And that distance surely must win Tessa Sanderson the medal.
Winner of the gold medal, representing Great Britain, Olympic champion, Daley Thompson.
It's Great Britain 1 and 2. It's Coe against Cram for gold and silver. Into the home straight. Coe leads, and Coe looks good. And Coe, I think, is going to get the gold. And Coe has beaten Cram. And what a marvellous finish. And Seb Coe gets the gold medal. Steve Cram the silver. Sensation. Mary Decker has fallen and fallen into the infield and is out of the race. She clashed with Zola Bird, and Mary Decker is lying on the infield, and now the gold medal is wide open indeed. The crowd stunned almost into silence, and the little frail South African girl, and boos raising all around this stadium because Mary Decker tripped when she bumped into Zola Bird and is out of the race.
Some of the triumphs and one of the tragedies of Los Angeles. There were 5 gold medals for Britain, 83 for the United States, and 15 for China, which sent representatives to the Olympics for the first time since 1952. But there were no medals for the England cricket team. They picked up 2 unenviable firsts. They lost a test series to New Zealand and were beaten 5-0 by the touring West Indies, the first England side to suffer a whitewash at home. But at least they won a test in India. In rugby union, Scotland achieved the Grand Slam for the first time in 59 years. The problems of Northern Ireland were once again marked by acts of violence and terrorism, with more police and soldiers falling victim to the gunman and the bomber. In March, the provisional Sinn Féin leader, Gerry Adams, was shot and wounded. The following month, magistrate Tom Travers and his daughter Mary were shot as they walked home from church. And in August, one man was killed and 20 injured when police tried to arrest Martin Galvin, a director of NORAID, at a Republican rally in Belfast. He'd been banned from entering Northern Ireland. In September, Mr. James Pryor resigned as Northern Ireland secretary and was succeeded by Mr. Douglas Hurd. Mr. Pryor made it clear that he'd not stepped down in order to criticise the government from the back benches.
I've been a member of Mrs. Thatcher's government for over 5 years. I've been a member of her team now ever since she became leader. I am a Conservative. It would be utterly wrong now, and I think would be seen by the public as being wrong as well, if I suddenly turned around the day I leave office and criticised everything that I'd had to defend whilst I was in government for 5 years. No, I'm not going to do that. On the other hand, I will say what I have to say when the time comes.
John DeLorean's problems with his car factory in Northern Ireland were cited by the prosecution at his trial in Los Angeles as the reason he'd become involved in a multi-million pound drugs deal. He was charged with conspiring to possess and distribute cocaine, but was acquitted on all 8 counts.
I, of course, knew from day one that I was innocent. I clearly felt that the judgment would come out properly. My only concern is that the complexity of the situation made it difficult to communicate the true facts, but I never gave a moment's concern to it outside of the normal things. I've aged about 600 years in the last 2, and that life as a hard-working industrialist has been tattered and torn. I don't know, would you buy a used car from me?
In July, a Nigerian politician, Mr. Umaru Dikku, was found drugged and unconscious in a crate at Stansted Airport. An outspoken opponent of the military government in Lagos, he'd been kidnapped outside his home in London and was about to be forcibly returned to Nigeria, where he faces charges of alleged corruption. 3 Israelis and a Nigerian diplomat were arrested and charged with kidnapping and drugging Mr. Dikku. It was also in July that fire destroyed the roof of the south transept of York Minster and that sensors under the Irish Sea recorded this sound.
The floor just moved. The building moved. It was like a seesaw.
Suddenly, the desk started to move. My chair started to move. One of my colleagues across the room shouted that this building is shaking.
I leapt out of bed, wondering what the hell was going on, and realised it could be an earth tremor. We were just sitting having a cup of tea, and all of a sudden the chair rocked. We all looked at one another. We thought somebody was doing something. Until the cups on the wall, they started rattling.
I put my hand on the bedroom wall and it seemed to be coming into me. I really thought the walls were just going to crack.
The earthquake, centred off the coast of North Wales, was the most powerful in Britain for 100 years. It caused some damage to buildings, but no one was hurt. In August, an outbreak of salmonella poisoning at the Stanley Royd Hospital in Wakefield claimed 27 lives. Relations between Britain and South Africa deteriorated after six anti-apartheid campaigners took refuge in the British consulate in Durban. Britain refused to evict them, and so the Pretoria government refused to return four South Africans to Britain, where they faced charges of arms smuggling. The South African Foreign Minister, Mr. Pikbuta.
Of course we have not broken our word arbitrarily and voluntarily. If you throw a stone through my window, then I pick up a stone and throw it through your window. This was not of my making. There comes a time that the government of the day in this country must exert its authority. And the only thing we could do when the British government said it was not prepared to abide by the Vienna Convention to which you are a subscriber. You said you will not abide by it. Secondly, you said you were not going to allow South African law to be enforced. What choice did you leave me?
So there's no chance of these four being sent back now?
No, when a window is broken, it is broken, both sides.
In mid-September, a second son was born to the Prince and Princess of Wales, Prince Henry Charles Albert David. He's third in line to the throne after his father and his elder brother, Prince William. Prince Charles was at St Mary's Hospital in Paddington for the birth and spoke briefly to reporters as he left.
Were you expecting a boy?
No, I mean, it doesn't matter what it was. As long as it was all right. And it was.
Everybody seems to be so happy to
you. Well, thank you very much.
How's Princess Diana, sir? How's Princess Diana?
Very well. Everything couldn't have gone better. No, it was much quicker this time than last time.
What does the baby look like?
I've no idea yet.
What colour? You've chosen the name, sir. What colour
eyes? They're pale blue at the moment.
And his hair?
Sort of indeterminate colour at the moment.
You chose a name, sir.
We've nearly got a full polo team, so I think all that.
If Prince Harry's arrival was expected, the sudden appearance in Moscow of the Soviet defector Oleg Bitov was not. He claimed he'd been kidnapped by the British Secret Service in Venice and smuggled to Britain, where he was tortured and brainwashed. His story sounded like a classic of spy fiction, and that's what the British authorities said it was. Bitov was not the only Soviet citizen to return from the West. Stalin's daughter Svetlana decided to go home after 17 years in the United States and Britain, and two Russian soldiers who deserted in Afghanistan also left London for Moscow. The plight of 6 million starving people in Ethiopia was brought dramatically to the world's attention in October by a BBC television report.
Dawn. And as the sun breaks through the piercing chill of night on the plain outside Corum, it lights up a biblical famine, now in the 20th century. This place, say workers here, is the closest thing to hell on earth. Thousands of wasted people are coming here for help. Many find only death. They flood in every day from villages hundreds of miles away, dulled by hunger, driven beyond the point of desperation. 15,000 children here now, suffering, confused, lost. Death is all around. A child or an adult dies every 20 minutes. Corum, an insignificant town, has become a place of grief.
Michael Burke's account of the suffering had an immediate impact. Aid flooded into Ethiopia from all over the world and continues to do so. At the beginning of November, a quarter of a million people gathered in Warsaw for the funeral of Father Jerzy Popieluszko, a pro-solidarity priest whose body had been found in a reservoir 11 days after he'd been kidnapped. Kevin Ruane was at the service.
Bell tolled as the coffin was carried to the grave. Popular's body was lowered into a grave in the corner of the churchyard, with Cardinal Glemp, several bishops, Lechfluenza and others, standing amid solidarity banners and hands raised high in the victory salute.
The circumstances surrounding the sinking of the Argentine cruiser General Belgrano during the Falklands War were widely discussed during the year. Amid allegations of a government cover-up, it was revealed that two logs from the submarine Conqueror had disappeared. The government insisted, though, that the Belgrano was a threat to the task force and that her course and speed were irrelevant when the decision was made to attack her. 3 weeks after the funeral of Mrs. Gandhi, India was the scene of another political murder when Britain's Deputy High Commissioner in Bombay, Mr. Percy Norris, was shot dead by unidentified gunmen believed to be Arab extremists. A short time afterwards, there was a huge environmental disaster at the city of Bhopal. Poisonous gas leaked from a pesticide plant, and more than 2,000 people died. Well over 100,000 were treated for the effects of the gas in what easily the worst ever industrial accident. The panic and confusion gave way to a deathly calm near the plant, witnessed by Mark Tully.
The area is unusually quiet. It should be very noisy because on the walls you can see pasted the election symbols, and this area should be full of people campaigning for the general election, but in fact it's almost totally deserted. In this house there's the dead body of a mother and two children, and no one has come to take them away. Now there is a young boy here who has been affected. He's sitting here holding his head in his hands. There's a young woman lying here with cotton wool over her eyes, and a young man also on the same bed. Both of them got cotton wool over their eyes. And two of their children, actually, have been badly affected by this gas.
In Mexico City, hundreds of people were killed in an explosion at a gas plant in a crowded suburb of the city. More than 2,000 were injured in that accident. The world of stage and theatre lost many of its most noted and best-loved performers during the year, including Richard Burton, Dame Flora Robson, James Mason, and Leonard Rossiter, while millions of people will miss the talents of Eric Morecambe, Tommy Cooper, and Diana Dawes. Two of Britain's greatest men of letters also died in 1984, J.B. Priestley and Sir John Betjeman. We end this review of the year with an excerpt from one of Sir John's poems, read by himself. Christmas.
And is it true? For if it is, no loving fingers tying strings around those tissued fripperies, the sweet and silly Christmas things, bath salts and inexpensive scent, and hideous tie so kindly meant. No love that in a family dwells, no carolling in frosty air, nor all the steeple-shaking bells can with this single truth compare, that God was man in Palestine and lives today in bread and wine.
News Review of the Year was presented by Michael Vesti. The programme was produced for Radio News by John Allen. Next Sunday morning at 11:15, the return of a new series of Weekend.